Group Meeting, Friday, 12th February 1982. This is our anniversary group weekend. 20 years have been completed since we started with these group meetings. The first meeting took place on the 10th of February, Saturday the 10th of February, 1962. And of course, this weekend is the nearest to the 10th of February, and so it is our anniversary weekend. So far, we have had 345 Friday meetings, 364 Saturday meetings, and Frank Dennis over there is one of the founder members of that Saturday group. He has survived 20 years, the others have perished. And we have had 326 Sunday group meetings. The Friday group started in July 1962, and the Sunday group started in September 1963. So we have had 1,035 meetings altogether in this house, in this room. And now, in addition to those, we have had 13 summer schools for the members of our groups. Two or three of these summer schools were the earliest ones, and they took place in the house of Mr. and Mrs. Dashwood, Morris and Joan Dashwood, in Cobham. And here in this house we have had two or three summer schools. But of course, we can't take too many. We had to restrict numbers, and also I used to give them spicy Oriental curry and rice, savory rice. Then we have had summer schools at Catherington House, at Horndean near Portsmouth, and at the retreat place at Park Place. Then we've had summer schools at Park Place Retreat Center, run by the sisters there, and the Mother Superior of the whole order was also the head of that place. And then we've had two summer schools at the Giltalian Community Center, St. Mary's House, Buxted. And last year we've had our group meetings, our summer school, at the Cenacle, Greyshot, near Hindhead. That's the place to which we will be going this year also. It's very, very nice, excellently run in every respect, food, the beauty of the place, and everything is marvelous there. I'm afraid the cost, because they have increased their charges by 27%, will be £73 for the week, you see. Now, at these summer schools, group members have made valuable contributions with talks, discussions, music, and with organizing and other services. In the summer schools, 136 talks have been given in the 13 summer schools. This includes 8 talks which were given by members of the groups, and 2 by guest speakers. John Moore, the publisher of my book, The Heart of Religion, and by the late Stanley Jeeves, who gave a marvelous talk and pictures entitled Amadeus, mostly about the life of Mozart. And it was beautifully done. Everybody enjoyed it very much. Of course, it was more entertainment than anything to do with religion. However, that's that. And to one and all, our grateful thanks are due for all that they have done by their presence, by their steadiness, and so forth. We have had approximately 350 or more people come to these as members to the meetings, but most of them have evaporated. Over 250 have evaporated. But our sort of steady, stable core consists of about 80 people. So that's not too bad. So several people come out of curiosity only. Others find that this is not their cup of tea. Others come with various expectations and preconceived ideas and so forth, and they disappear. And some come expecting to get some wonder working, you know, and magical powers and psychic this and that and all that nonsense. You see, and of course, I shall never stand for any nonsense where religion and the religious life is concerned. So they also have disappeared. But about 80 remain. And Jerome is one of the founder members of the Friday group. And Dick Patterson, he's 82 or 3 now. He was one of the founder members of the Sunday group. Some of our 90-year-olds, Mrs. Perrett and Mrs. McConnell, they died. So I expect they are listening to wiser counsels. Now, I want to say a word about the sort of spirit that animates our work. In ancient India, there was no advertising of any sort where religious teachers were concerned, and certainly no self-advertising. So much so that the teachings of some of the greatest of the teachers has been recorded much later by their followers and disciples under a pseudonym, not their own name. A good many own names are there also, but by far the larger proportion of them are pseudonyms. To give you one example, the famous creation hymn in the 10th book of the Rig Veda is attributed to Prajapati Parameshthin. But that is not a man's name like John Smith is a man's name. Prajapati means Lord of creatures. Pati means Lord. Praja means the population. And in this case, the population included the whole of the animal world. So Prajapati and Parameshthin. Parameshthin means the supreme being. Now, which man who had realized saintship would call himself the supreme being? It sounds frightfully conceited, doesn't it? But that is how he is remembered, as Prajapati Parameshthin. The true spiritual teachers and yogis lived in forest hermitages on the outskirts of villages near to a stream. From far and wide, perceptive, sensitive people, seriously concerned with living the religious life, recognized these teachers by their obvious personal purity. We must note this very carefully, but they are obvious personal purity and they are saintly lives. What they said, they did. As they did, they spoke. The truth they had realized, they gave to the truth lover who had proved his worth. They asked for no fees, touched no gold, sought no public honors or fame. They lived the holy life, which in Sanskrit and Pali we call the Brahmacharya, the holy life. So they were a benediction to their people and to their environment. The people, out of gratitude, saw to it that their minimal necessities for existence were satisfied. That is how they lived. All sorts of disciples came to them, ranging from illegitimates and utterly poor folk, right up to kings. They came to them as pupils. And what they gave, the kings, for instance, brought fuel, which was the usual sign which a person gave to the teacher that he wanted to be a disciple. He brought fuel. Because remember that these great Upanishadic and Vedic teachers lived in northern India, where it could be very cold, you see, for a few months of the year. So fuel was what they brought as their fee. And the kings occasionally presented them with cows, because the cow was their mainstay in that civilization. Now, our concern here all these years has been not so much the intellectual study of religion, but the living of the religious life. This is of fundamental importance. What is the meaning of the word religion? If you take it from its Latin derivation, either re legere or re ligare. One was given by Cicero, the other was given by Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine. It means a binding back to the Supreme, to the source from whence we come. And there was the tacit acknowledgement that the source from whence we come was the ultimate reality, if you wanted to talk only in philosophical terms, or God, or Brahman, or Atma, or the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, or anything, whatever name you gave to it. But that was the supreme unknown and unknowable. But it could be realized by living the holy life, the religious life in the true sense, because by living the holy life, the finite mortal person underwent a complete transmutation of consciousness. And therefore he was at one, made one with the totality, with the supreme, with the ultimate, the total reality, you see. Now, religion means that. And the forms in which that has been expressed in the world's history have been many. Perhaps not so many. The great religions are only a few in number. But they all are agreed on certain points. The morality which they lay down is the identical morality in each and every religion. And the necessity for transcending selfness, to be completely free, not of mere ordinary selfishness. People in the ordinary way can be unselfish by sort of because of their conditioning, because they've been brought up that way, because they can forcibly say to themselves, no, I mustn't do that, that would be selfish. Therefore, I must be unselfish. Now, that means conflict within one's own psyche. The must be, the ought to be, always entails conflict. But here, if one lives the holy life in the right way, and also disciplines the psyche and the mind, at the same time, then one undergoes a complete transmutation of one's own awareness of the nature of existence. This is what becomes different. We are aware of existence in a certain way now, as we are, according to our innate capacities, according to our upbringing, our education, and all that happens in the course of our development, what we receive from society, our cultural heritage, and all the rest of it, you see. So, this transmutation is the really important thing. And therefore, the religiousness which is inherent in man is a religious being, and only secondarily is he a political, economic and social animal. Now, note the distinction carefully. As a being, he is a religious being. But as an animal, because the psychophysical organism, after all, is an animal organism, he is a political, economic and social animal. You see? But if this animal is rightly treated, and intelligently understood and intelligently disciplined, the animal or the defects and limitations of the animal organism are completely transformed into supreme virtue. The what we call the spiritual values, love, truth, goodness, beauty, and all the rest of it. You see? This is the important thing to bear in mind. Therefore, the forms in which religion has been presented, important as they are, and they do convey some sort of thrill, some sort of vibration, if you like, of the transcendent itself, the forms we can utilize according to our own capacity and according to our own natural inclination. Because just as with ordinary everyday food, certain types of food agree with us better than other types of food. Very well, therefore you naturally take what is suitable and good for your own living organism. So too with religion and religious, that is to say the conventional orthodox presentations of the religions. But the religiousness in us has to be brought into full fruition. So in our all these years, no particular faith has been emphasized here or exalted above any other faith. I try to draw from all the religions of the world except Islam, for the very simple reason that I'm ignorant of it. I'm not only ignorant of Islam, I'm ignorant of so much that I do, that there is only one thing that I know for certain, and that is that I do not know. Now, nor do we regard all religions as equal. They are unique because of the time, the place, the circumstances, the nature of the people, their past history, their cultural development, all that has played its part in the formulation of their religion, of their religious systems. So now, each religion is unique, and all who come here to this house come freely. There is no compulsion, there is no expectation, there is no hope. I mean, I have none of those things, because these are all limitations I would place on you if I had them. You see? So you come completely freely, and you're equally free not to come, just as you please. Makes no difference at all. I just do the work I can do and have to do here. No beliefs or rituals or systems of thought or meditation are imposed, none whatsoever. You choose your own way because you, the living person, the psychophysical being, the existential being, the mortal finite being, you yourself are the way. The way lies within you and your life process. Therefore, nothing is imposed from outside. No fees of any sort are demanded or expected, or contributions to a begging bowl or any such thing. Thank goodness I don't need to beg yet. I have done this work from the beginning, depending on my own earnings and so forth, and everything is freely given. It has to be freely given if it is to be worth anything at all. But if members feel happy by and wish to express their gratitude and appreciation by giving money or fruit or beautifully made pots or whatever they are as a free gift, they are all thankfully accepted as such. Those who give, as well as those who do not or cannot give because they can't afford anything, are all welcome. As long as I live, so will it be. For the spirit, like love, wisdom, beauty, cannot be bought or sold. That is the principle on which all those ancient spiritual teachers and the founders of the great religions worked. The spirit cannot be bought or sold. As long as I can maintain this situation here independently, I will continue to serve you wholeheartedly. Please note, to serve you, I'm your servant. I am your fellow student, not your teacher. Please don't call me or regard me as a teacher. Time and again I find, as the months and years go by, what slips I have made in my talks. And if one mark were deducted for each slip, by this time I should have naught out of 100. Life itself is our teacher, and the book of life, written each day by each and every one of us, is our holy book. So, learn to be absolutely independent. Stand on your own feet. Be a light unto yourselves. Be like the stars in heaven, which give such wonderful joy to us with their twinkling lights. Be lights like that, and bear in mind that immense distances separate each star. The stars are alone, and they are self-shining lights. That's the important point. No reflected light, no man-made light. It's a divine light. It has been produced, brought into being by the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy which out of which emerged everything else. What is the first thing we say about God? God the Creator, the maker of heaven and earth and all that. That sort of phraseology comes in all the religious teachings of the world. The Creator. And it is very important to note that we call ourselves human beings. We are not yet human. We are subhuman. We are growing towards full humanity. Because, and I say subhuman not pejoratively at all, but as a statement of fact. Because what does the word human mean? The Sanskrit root is man, is pronounced man. And out of the word man are derived the word man and the word mind. You see, note how Jesus says, he calls himself the Son of Man. And he says, and he asks his disciples, whom do you think I am? Because some said he was so and so come back, Elias come back, and all that sort of thing. You see, and Simon Bar Jonah, afterwards called Peter, so his voice rang out, "You are the living Christ, the Son of God." Just as in ancient India, all the holy ones were regarded as Brahmaputras, the sons of Brahma, the supreme being, the creator, you see. All right. Now, mind, man, and creation, they all go together. And this prefix hu, is interchangeable with the prefix su. S and H were interchangeable in India and in Iran, ancient Iran. You see, for instance, the Buddha was called the Sugata. That was one of the names, one of the titles given to him, the Sugata. Gata means he who has progressed thus. And Su means happy, the supremely happy. So the word human really means the happy, the blissful creator. But that's exactly what we say God is. See, isn't that extraordinary? That the word human really means that. That is our divine potentiality. It is the divine potentiality of every single human being that has been on the globe, is now on the globe, and will be born on this planet. That is his divine potentiality. But whilst that is the divine potentiality of the entire human race, only a few first fruits have come into being. Those who had realized the Supreme, who had at-oned themselves with the ultimate reality. And the at-onement is one of the deep meanings of the word atonement. When Jesus, it is said of Jesus that he was crucified, died on the cross. Now there is a theory that he didn't die on the cross. And in India for centuries, in Kashmir, they have always believed that he didn't die on the cross, that he was taken down from the cross, and his life was saved, he was nursed and tended, and he went to India, to Kashmir, and taught there. And there is a sect, a Muslim sect, called the Qadiani sect, which has a tradition of teachings which came from a Muslim teacher, Yus Asaf, as they called him, spoke in parables and so on, very similar to those which Jesus used. You see, there is his tomb in Srinagar, Yus Asaf's tomb, but whether Yus Asaf is the same as Jesus is a bit questionable, because you see, after all, the Muhammad, who founded the Muslim faith, was born centuries after 680 or somewhere there, I forget the exact date, after Jesus, you see. Very good. So that's something to be borne in mind. The meaning of the word human, and therefore the significance and importance of religion. I always say that the truly human life, the practical, sensible, truly human life is the same as the divine life, the religious life, the holy life. They are an identity. Now, since some of us have spent 20 years meeting, I thought it might be useful to take stock of ourselves. But there is a little danger in this taking stock of ourselves. It is subhuman weakness. You know the old Latin saying, errare est humanum. It is human to err. No, it is subhuman to make mistakes. Not human. You see? It is subhuman to make mistakes. And I being still subhuman, even if I were to take stock of myself, I might suffer from either elation, that, oh, I did that well, and therefore pride and conceit and self-esteem, vanity, egoism, they are all satisfied. Or I might wring my hands and beat my breasts and say, what horrible things I've done, what a fool I've been. And that wouldn't be very far wrong. But and then there'd be this a sense of guilt troubling one, and that causes only more illness and conflict. Guilt complex. Complex is the word, yes, I wanted. In the soul. So that's no use. One has to examine oneself quite calmly, dispassionately. No praise, no blame. Just look at the fact as it is. And then only it can be of use to you. Otherwise, it will only cause more trouble. And we have quite enough troubles, especially these days. So it might be useful to take stock of ourselves in the right way by inquiring if we have grown quieter. Now, this quietness is of fundamental importance. You know how silence has played one of the most important parts in all the great religious disciplines of the world. Has played and still should play and will continue to play in the years to come. Quietness is very essential. You know how in the school of Pythagoras, for the first 2 years, they were called the akoustikoi, just listeners. They listened. They never spoke, except to say yes, no, thank you, or something like that. That's all. Just quietly consider for yourselves. If the world did that today, the whole world did that today, do you think there'd be the world would be in the state that it is, on the brink of a precipice? We are literally right near the edge of the precipice. And the noise we make with our particular thinking, feeling, our desires, our ambitions, our envies, our jealousies, our suspicions, our fears and our hatreds, and so forth, all that makes such a tremendous noise. The brain is all the time occupied with that. What's your thought process? What's your daily fantasies when you have fantasies? As a creative artist, of course, you have fantasies in connection with your art, naturally. Otherwise, we would never have had Shakespeare and Beethoven and the whole lot of them. You see, we would never have had them if they hadn't this capacity for creative imagination, which is a very different thing. But otherwise, quietness. And you'll find that the stream of silent chatter which goes on in the brain centers round the word I, mostly. You can hardly, when we say I'm thinking, you see, in your thinking process, the word I will occur probably 2 or 3 times on the average in every single long sentence. It's an extraordinary thing, but there it is. Now, have we equanimity, calmness of mind, balance, poise. Have we become a little more perceptive, able to see into people, into things, and above all, develop the capacity to see the fact as the fact? Have we become more sensitive? This is very important. More sensitive. And with sensitivity will go true refinement, not the sort of imposed culture of good manners only. You see, one can be very good mannered without being truly refined within oneself. And watching one's fantasies and the way one reacts to every impulse and every stimulus that comes to us, by watching our reaction to it, we can see whether we are refined or unrefined in actuality, although we may appear very refined on the surface, which is like putting on a cloak, the cloak of refinement. Do we understand ourselves? Have we grown in self-knowledge? This is a point of fundamental importance, because unless we really grow in self-knowledge, all our efforts, if we do have to make efforts at religious living, at truly human living, will always be frustrated. They will always be frustrated, because that within the self which is the slave of self-orientedness, self-centeredness, will always destroy whatever good impulse we may have, either through natural and spontaneous goodwill or through an imposed, "I ought to do this because it is good to do so." Beware of the imposed, "I ought to." Beware of it. Are we free of bias, prejudice, preconception, and assumption? All assumptions and preconceptions have no warrant whatsoever where the supreme truth is concerned. We can talk, we can write books, we can lecture, we can do all those things very learnedly, if you like, but there are always underlying assumptions. There are underlying preconceptions. Nothing can be communicated by us in our ordinary way, by conversation or by the written word or anything, without these underlying preconceptions and assumptions. And they are invariably wrong. As you grow, you will discover that, oh, I have done this or said this because such and such a preconception, but that isn't quite true. If you don't discover that as the years go by, then, well, we are just on the scrap heap. And unhappily, the human race flourishes just like a tree flourishes. The tree is a one thing. Its leaves every year are countless. In autumn, what happens to them? In the spring, a whole new lot come out, you see. And the human race has gone on in this fashion, without knowing it. The fruit and the flower of this tree of humanity, well, they are very few indeed. But that doesn't mean that we should not wake up to what is our potentiality and what is our real destiny, our divine destiny. We should wake up to that and not bother whether we have achieved this or not achieved it and so forth. Achievement and attainment don't count. very much. You just grow up like Topsy, naturally and sweetly. That's all, you see. Are we harmonious within ourselves? Because if we are not harmonious within ourselves, we cannot spread harmony elsewhere. So many people rush about the world pestering their fellow human beings with doing good, the do-gooders of the world. They are a bigger nuisance than the honestly selfish people. Are we more observant? Now, observation is a very important point in the religious life. And by that, I mean this. All the time, stimuli are coming to us through the avenues of our senses. And have you ever noticed carefully, have you ever responded to the fact that all the time that these stimuli come, the brain is talking back at them? Now, if the brain is talking back at them, passing judgments and so forth, censure, praise, I like this, I'll have more of it, I don't like this, I'll destroy it, I'll fight against it. All that nonsense goes on because the brain is talking back at it. Now, if we watched all that very carefully and also observe all the stimuli that come to us and the source and the manner and the event and the circumstance through which they come to us, then we shall be developing a true power of observation. Then we will see truth in the religious sense. Are we growing free, more and more free of greed, hate, delusion, fear, violence, ambition, and all the rest of the things that make for the sorrow and suffering and difficulty not only of ourselves but of all mankind? Are we growing free of that? Are we free of clinging to what is passing away and of grasping at what we would like to have or what is naturally coming to us? Those are great enemies of human fruition. We remain subhuman with our clinging and with our grasping. Don't merely wish to do good in the particular way in which you think good should be done, because it will always be wrong. I don't know. The divine knows. And when I can be quiet and stop making a noise, then the divine comes into its own through this same finite mortal creature. That is how it happens, really. Can we look? Can we listen? And use all our senses rightly. That is, without helpless reaction. I know in my own case, for instance, when I hear some of these so-called modern music and pop singers and all that sort of noise, it absolutely, I have to watch myself very, very carefully. You see? And if I can watch myself carefully, then my nerves are not shattered. I can absorb it. Consider this fact. Supposing we talk in ordinary theistic terms and take the ordinary theistic belief, God made the universe. Does he reject any part of the universe? He made it. He knows he's responsible for it. All right? I've made my cup of tea, so I drink it, says God. Now, can't we do that? So, look dispassionately, but with clear understanding and deep sympathy. And if we can look dispassionately, then we will find that compassion and wisdom and real goodness will all emerge out of us naturally, because it is all there, that divine potential is there, and it will express itself in all these different ways. Have we more insight into truth? Truth, not ideas, beliefs, conceptions, systems of thought and whatnot. They are all fixed fixations, mental fixations. We have to outgrow all mental fixations, because they are always faulty. My mental fixations are the result of my imperfect brain at work, assisted by my conditioning, my upbringing, my life experience and all the rest of it. All this is faulty. All of it is finite, temporal, mortal. The Lord of death is Lord of all this. But if I can really see that and let go, be at ease, be at home in the cosmos, in the real sense of the word, being at home, then everything becomes different. And you see truth in the real sense. That is to say, you are awake to the immediate reality, the now. And the now is not a fixed point. It is a perpetually changing point. But it remains now, here, now. So you see, that is ourself. Ourself is the perpetual here now. And the implication of all this is that one realizes freedom from all selfness. That doesn't mean, it must not be mistaken as the destruction of the ego or the self, not at all. But the ego, the self, has become completely at one with the totality. And that is the ultimate human fulfillment. Not your individual fulfillment, but the fulfillment of transcendence itself through you.